Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
The Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. JD Bunkus, and I stole our next guest's. I stole his guys, all his takes. I'm trying to make him do his takes now. Bourne, I got Sammy's takes earlier. I was like, listen to Real Kipper and Bourne later today. But here's a little preview right now with JD, Justin Bourne of said show. What's up, buddy?
Not too much. How's it going with McKee? Is it weird? You guys are too close of friends to be radio hosts together.
No, honestly, it actually is good. It's good. You know, like, it's been working. We're chopping it up.
I think it's good. I hope it's good.
Yeah, I mean, tell us if it stinks. At JD Bunkus, at Sam A. McKee. Let us know. Does this stink? Do you hate this? Is this brutal? Okay, so we're going to start on a lighter note with this. I'm going to kind of defer to Sammy because he's been sitting on some McDavid take about him skating in Toronto, and I need to hear it.
Oh my God!
It's not necessarily a take, but it's just seeing him skating on the ice. And yucking it up with Spezza. Spezza's asking him about the stick, and he's on the bench. He's got a smile on his face. You can't tell me he's not like, oh, this is my full dream coming true. I'm on the Leafs ice. Like, there's something to this. I'm sorry. You don't let – like, why are the Oilers letting him do this? Like, why are they letting him around their facility? Like, why are they letting him see how sick it is to be a Toronto Maple Leaf? I don't understand this.
Is it that sick? He's like, I could be with Adam Godet?
Well – yeah. He's like, my dream's to play with Kubel. I don't know if I'm an Oiler fan or an Oiler executive, I would not be happy with him being on the ice.
McKee,
is that not weird?
It's like you absolutely trust your significant other, but you don't need them to go have dinner with Brad Pitt. Yeah. Nothing's going to happen.
And you definitely don't want to see it if it goes down. You don't want to see it if it's happening.
Spezza's got a smile on his face. He's like looking at him like, that is weird. If I'm the Oilers, it's like, hey, we have $1 billion. Rent out another rink. That's just such a weird move to me.
Rent out another rink. I'm going to jump in on this and just
Moss Park's available.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in on this and say how I truly feel, which is, I don't think that Austin Matthews is ever going to Arizona. I think that that's outrageous. I actually think that's like the funniest thing that anybody like remotely believes is true. That the guy who wants to do like GQ covers and hang out with like Justin Bieber, that he would ever go be in like Arizona and just playing golf all the time. Like, that's not that dude. I have been thinking more about the potential of Matthews leaving, obviously, given like the state of the Toronto Maple Leafs, the what just happened with Johnny Gaudreau. Like, it's just natural to be thinking about it. But part of me is comforted knowing that McDavid will sign here someday. It's just a matter of, will he sign here in the Eric Lindros vein, where it's like it's all over and we're all just kind of like, oh, that's cool, this is 10 years too late. Or will it be like the John Tavares thing where he just goes, hey, Edmonton, I gave you the best years of my life, and now I'm going to do my second act in Toronto where like it falls off a bit, but I'm still McDavid. Like, you know, I'm comforted by that at night.
The one thing with McDavid is he exists around media like it just is bugs under his skin. And to go to a bug-infested place like Toronto would be hard for him. I agree that it probably happens in some capacity, but boy, it'll make him uncomfortable at times.
Okay, so off of the fun stuff, okay? You ready now to do the less fun stuff, buddy?
Fun stuff, they got new players! Woohoo! Here come the Leafs!
Yeah, I painted the picture already, but I'm going to do it again with you. Just to demonstrate, this is the Dennis system, demonstrate value. The Leafs that are in, money-wise, market-wise, Matt Murray, 2 years left at 4.68 per season. Okay, but yeah, that money is not good money because the Senators paid a third-round pick to do it and retained even some of the salary. Ilya Samsonov, 1 year, $1.8 million. Adam Gaudette, 1 year, $7.5 million. Nicholas Obey-Kubel, 1 year, $1 million. Leafs out. Ilya Mikheyev, 4 years, $4.75 million. Jack Campbell, 5 years, $5 million. Labushkin, 2 years, $2.8 million AAV. Blackwell, 2 years, $1.2 million AAV. Kasha, 1 year, $1.5 million. What does it say when you take like the three forwards that you brought in and they add up to like a little over an Andrei Kasha?
Well, it says that your general manager had success the previous summer buying low and finding value. Yes, he did.
Yeah, okay.
And he is looking to do the same thing again this year. He thinks that could be Adam Gaudette and Nicholas Aubé-Kubel, I guess, is what it says.
Okay. All right. I'll say there was a lot more hype around Michael Bunting and the fact that he was from the Toronto area and that, like, he actually had, I would say, more of a market, but he read it as, I'm going to go to Toronto. I want to be in Toronto, and I'm going to have, like, a very unique opportunity to play up the lineup, which with two, like, megastar players, which I wouldn't have had in another place. So that one works. Okay, that one tracks. I think the David Camp signing is one of Kyle Dubas's best moves, especially when you look at it through the vacuum of, like, the numbers were not overly friendly to this guy. There was not a lot of buzz around him. I don't think that people had, you know, positive David Camp takes when they signed him. So I will give him, like, people, there was buzz about Michael Bunting. There was zero buzz for David Camp. But this is the kind of the thing that I want to ask you today, because I'm looking at this through the lens of today. Here's how I feel. Kyle Dubas inherited one of the best situations in all of hockey at the time. He had the market. He had the young players. He had, we can disagree on whether or not he had the coach, but it wasn't like they were spending, like, the ownership at least was going to be able to spend money on coaches. He got the latitude. He had the resources, whether it's, you know, money for scouting departments or now, you know, their goaltending department, whatever. Like, everything, every resource was essentially at his disposal with one of the things that's most coveted in the game, multiple young stars on deals that needed to be negotiated as restricted free agents. What to you right now is, like, the best remaining move, like, that is a part of this Toronto Maple Leafs team? Or what do you think has been Kyle Dubas's, like, signature move since acquiring the general manager position with the Toronto Maple Leafs?
I don't know. I mean, probably Jack Campbell. He's gone, so yeah. Muzzin is what's left at this point. I don't know. I feel I'm interested in the timing of this conversation. Like, yesterday was a really disappointing, massive, what I would say, the first time for the Toronto Maple Leafs since I've been covering them closely that I'm like, oh boy, this is trouble. The Leafs look like they're in trouble. They're reeling a little bit here. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I then look at everything that's happened to the Leafs and say, actually, Dubas has done a bad job. This team has been good for years and gotten better consistently. I don't know that there is, you know, what the best remaining signature move is. I don't know. Is there somewhere you're trying to steer me with that?
Well, I'll tell you this, is that we can say that the Leafs have been good for years, but again, they were a good team when he got the team. Like, the reason that they are good is because he inherited three awesome players, and then John Tavares signed here to be with those awesome players because he's mostly from here. I don't believe that it was a sales pitch from Kyle Dubas. In fact, if you really want to give guys credit for, like, the Tavares signing, more of that, I think, goes to Mike Babcock than it does Kyle Dubas, from my understanding of the situation. The reason why this is coming up now is because, for two reasons. One is that when we looked at run it back, it was that, okay, you know what? This Leafs team is close in a lot of ways, so they've got to make sure that they capitalize on this right now. And I'm looking at this and saying, okay, well, yesterday did not help me improve that. In fact, it made me look at sort of the process in terms of how we got here. Because, like, this was my take when they signed or they acquired Matt Murray and that they've now signed Ilya Samsonov. I go, given the options, this isn't that bad to me. Like, you brought in an asset, a third-round pick. You didn't have to pay a goaltender a term of into the 5 million or the 5 year range. But the process in which you got here was not a good one. You did not develop an internal goalie candidate. It's hard to do, but you didn't develop anybody. You misread the goaltending market a year ago. And yeah, you had a situation where you ran into a fundamental dispute with a player in Freddie Anderson that allowed this kind of to be telegraphed in a certain way, which is what I think ended up happening here with the Jack Campbell trade and has a lot, or the Jack Campbell loss, which has a lot to do with why they had to absorb more money in the trade for Matt Murray. I looked through every single move that Kyle Dubas has made as a general manager through a trade, and basically his best trades, if you go through them, are like trade downs in the draft. Like, those are the best moves that he has made pretty consistently, where, and like, I'm talking about guys that haven't even really helped this team except for the Sandin trade. Even the Jack Campbell trade, I think, is a win for the Toronto Maple Leafs in the trade market, but they still did give up two third-round picks and, like, an NHL player in Trevor Moore to acquire that player, like, and Kyle Clifford. The Jake Muzzin deal, they didn't want to give up Sean Durzi, and they ended up blinking and giving up Sean Durzi along with a first-round pick and Carl Grundstrom. These are moves that have worked out, I think, for the Leafs. But there's no, like, unanimous win in the trade market. And in fact, he's made two of the worst ones. And the biggest thing I wanted to bring up with you today and where I'm kind of steering you is I think that I've realized my biggest issue with the Kyle Dubas plan here, which has been the inability to ever turn the own rentals into other pieces that help this organization move forward. And that's why I did the Leafs in, Leafs out from a value standpoint. I get that it's free agency day, and this is a team that always is going to be built to, hey, we're going to carry free agents in here because we're trying to win. But I'm looking at this Alex Kerfoot contract right now. I'm going, I've been told by people that he could make us up to $5 million next offseason. Why are they not flipping a player like this who is not integral to the organization to try to bring in either a longer-term asset that you can turn into a longer-term contract or cap space to keep that you can turn into somebody that you sign and keep around this core for a few more years? Like, why is it acceptable that year over year this team does not win and continues to lose guys like Mikheyev, who the market deems is worth $4.75 million, and now being able to look ahead that you would do the same thing with guys like the Camps of the world, guys like the Buntings of the world, and guys like the Kerfoots of the world?
Yeah, I would say that I agree that that is a probably the fatal flaw here has been the all-inness of every single year.
Yes.
Has led to the cupboard thinning out. I mean, you can go back at the deadline. You know, I think Kyle Dubas is like hyper aware that deals at the trade deadline can absolutely sink you, and that big UFA contracts can sink you. They don't get burned at UFA time, you know, save for this Matt Murray situation. In the past, anyway, they haven't gotten burned. But the deadline, the way they've pushed their chips in on their teams, has led them to hanging on to guys and getting nothing for them, or spending for guys who do nothing for them when they're here. So that's been the crippling day of the season for Dubas, not so much UFA time. I will say that, you know, sitting here today looking at what they've done so far, and I do think there is, you know, more to be done, it's not so much that I hate any of the individual deals outside of Murray. Like, Gaudette, sure, take a cheap swing. Abe Kubel, fine, good forechecker. Samsonov, worth a shot. But
yeah,
like
$1 million deals, who cares?
Yeah, right. But like, nothing is inspiring that they've gotten, that they're any different than they've been. And that's frustrating. And there seems to be this, I've used the word hubris a lot about this offseason for the Leafs, and where they just, Dubas seems to be saying, I believe in myself and everything I've always thought, and I'm not changing my way. In fact, I'm going all in on it, and we're going to see the same team and his plan and his strategy in its purest form this year, win, lose, or fired.
Yeah.
You're just mentioning there that like the free agency day isn't the day when Kyle Dubas sort of does stuff, but he doesn't do stuff on this day because there's never any cap space. Like, what's the contract that he's, the big contract he's signed on this day? I guess Brody, which was for four years for not that lot of, like, which was a great signing. That's probably his biggest win. But I think a lot of what happens on this day in terms of him not being that involved is self-inflicted with the four big contracts. I don't think there's ever a time where he has the space to be able to do it. Am I off on that?
No, I think you're right. And that's why another reason I hated the Murray thing so much. Oh, just, it drives me crazy. Not getting 50%.
You're talking to the Murray
retention.
Boys here, Borny.
Oh, I know. And in fact, the worst tweet of J.D. Bunkus's career was about 2 days ago when he tweeted something to the effect of, who even cares that he didn't get the retention? What, it's only
1.6? I regretted it the second I retweeted it.
Like $1.6 million additional dollars with the additional retention would have been massive for this team. And there's a lot of free agents that were available at this deadline that, you know, I just think they can't be players on because of the Murray money. Why do the Murray deal 2 or 3 days before UFA day where you can see what you can get out there?
Yep.
The timing made me just as crazy as the actual contract.
Dude, I was saying to Sam during the break, actually, that the goaltending market, the way it shook out, actually even made the Murray trade look worse because Kemper and, I saw some people predict that Kemper might make, like, $6 million on a 6-year deal.
Yeah.
And I went, boy, like, that's quite a haul for that guy. his contract's like fairly reasonable. Like the goaltending contracts are like unbelievably reasonable right now. Like even Samsonov, people went like he might make $3 million, and I went, oh my god. Well, you can't go in a free agency just hoping for Samsonov and having him over a barrel, and he goes for 1 year, 1.8. Like again, the Jack Campbell contract. I would rather have Matt Murray on a 2 year lottery ticket deal in a vacuum, than a 5 year deal on a I think Jack Campbell contract. But I would say that the way you did the business is the thing I have the biggest issue with. Ottawa was red hot for Claude Giroux. Everybody knew it. And what did they need? They needed cap space. They were desperate for it. And you blinked. And this is kind of the thing I was mentioning earlier with Dubas, is like he also blinked on the trade for Jake Muzzin. They wanted Jake Muzzin. The Kings wanted to get off of him. It was pretty clear that they were trade partners. Toronto was willing to give up a first-round pick and Carl Grunstrom, who they were very high on. They didn't want to give up Sean Durzi. They wanted to give up Timothy Liljegren. The Kings held their ground. Toronto blinked. Dubas gave up his guy. And so this is sort of where I'm at. The Leafs actually have a better history with signing free agents this time with the Brodies of the world. With some of the lottery tickets that you've mentioned, where it's like, hey, you've been able to acquire the Buntings and you've been able to go out and get veteran players who have signed in Toronto for actually like kind of cheap. Free agency should be a day of focus for Leaf fans. You know what shouldn't be? The trade market. Because time and time again, it's been proven that Kyle Dubas loses trades unless he's dumping one of his bad contracts.
Yeah, he's done a great job getting rid of bad deals.
He signs. He's done a really good job.
Turning Nick Ritchie into Labushkin was a wonderful bit of business there. But yeah, no, it has been a bit of a struggle in the trade front. You know, I am curious to see if there's still more to come. You mentioned Kerfoot, you know, as a potential guy who could move. Like, do they want to do something a little bit bigger and actually shake this group up in some capacity? What's going to happen with Sandin, who doesn't seem content to be the fourth left D, you know, in the group? By the way, once again, Kyle Dubas was asked about Sandin yesterday, and he mentioned, you know, Timothy and Rasmus are really coming along. If I were Rasmus, I'd be like, stop with the Timothy thing. I am not Timothy. I just think they're so desperate to give him the Liljegren contract, and that seems to be what Sandin is digging in that he does not want.
Well, what does it also say that they haven't moved Hall yet?
And they need to make a trade here. Like, look at what's the cap space for next year? Just over $2 million, and they still have to they can't go into the season with this as their bottom six. They still need to get Engvall done. They still need to get Sandin done. Like, there needs to be a trade to free up some money.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, they don't have much left here. It's thin.
They got to dump Hall. They got to literally give Hall away. Like, that's what's going to happen.
The bottom six right now is absolutely terrifying for the Leafs, and I'm curious to see, you know, I know that's where you can do cheap business, but some of the names of what they keep mentioning, they're not really going to try to have Alex Steeves or Nick Robertson or guys like that in the bottom six, are they? Like,
yes, they are.
It seems like
it's heading that direction.
Yeah, he keeps saying some combination of Joey Anderson, Nick Robertson, Alex Steeves, Wayne Simmons, and Kyle Clifford. Like, that's surely no. I don't know. There's work to be done in that regard.
Here's the thing, though, boys. It's absolutely the way that it's going, and it's been telegraphed now for a while from a lot of different people and a lot of different sources that they're going to lean more on the AHL next year, that they're going to give those shots to Robertson, to Steeves, and to Joey Anderson in particular, that those guys are going to represent the depth, that it feels like the strategy for next year is going to be you're running back that top four guys, and that the way you're supplementing around them, and like you have Kampf and you're going to have Engvall, I guess, even though like I'm really not even thrilled about the idea that they're bringing back Engvall. That'd be a guy that I'd be 100% trying to get on a cheaper deal, and again, trying to pivot off of to acquire a little bit more depth or some more flexibility, especially given what happened last year. But I'm looking at this right now and saying it seems to be that they did not look at – it's weird. The NBA championship got settled on, hey, depth. The NHL Stanley Cup was depth. And the Leafs have just kind of looked at the forward depth thing and been like, yeah, maybe we can recreate that with lottery tickets everywhere, when really, again, they've never promoted guys from the AHL since the very beginning that have actually worked out. And the lottery ticket thing that has already been kind of proven as, well, this is like a 50-50 proposition at best.
I wonder if when it's all said and done for Kyle Dubas, you know, let's just assuming the Leafs do not win the Stanley Cup this season, if he doesn't look back at you know, what happened with the Marlies and how he started out with that group, and recognize a place of failure there. You know, the guys who've come up through the system, because that was his team when I was, you know, with the organization. He was at the rink every day and paying attention to who's there. And eventually, you know, once he graduated and all the stars graduated, I think it became a much less of an area of focus. The team missed the playoffs this past season. You know, they haven't really developed. They haven't had picks. It just hasn't been a focus for the team. And now that you're years into taking swings at winning the Stanley Cup, it feels like a bit of an Achilles heel that they can't get any internal help.
Yeah. I'm just sort of terrified about a couple things with Dubas, and mostly what he's willing to do with the deadline in terms of, you know, mortgaging more future to kind of keep this team going in terms of him knowing that his job's on the line. And secondly, like, you've always talked about it, Borny, how proudful and how, you know, fiery a guy that Dubas is behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's a big part of him that wants, you know, like a huge part of him, the main part of him that really, really desperately wants to be right about this. You know, like, that really wants the four forward thing to work. That really
That's
wants...
the part that scares me more than the first part. I don't think Dubas will even necessarily have, like, the latitude to make the kind of crazy deal if he's... If this team's in season and they're not in the first... in the driver's seat and this isn't working out incredibly well, I don't think there's an assurance that he keeps that job. The second part is, I think, what a lot of people are worried about and why, like, Bourne, when you said, why is the conversation coming up this way today? It's like, because today, like, we have a clearer picture of everything, you know? Like, there could be a move that comes. There could be something that happens, of course, like, of course, and I'll give him credit when that comes. But as of today, it sure seems like that Sam fear is cropping up, and those, like, Achilles heels that you just mentioned, like, they're coming home to roost all sort of at the same time.
Yeah, I agree that the idea that, you know, that is my great conclusion. I mean that it feels like the year where he said, this is either ending in I told you so or I need a new job. This is just like all in on the way that he wants it done and the way that he wants to build it. And I guess to some respect, guys, I got to give him a little credit for that. Like, don't you want your GM to execute his own vision? Isn't that the idea? Not to kind of go, oh, well, this person said I should do this and that. It looks like it might be the wrong one. But, you know, I give him credit that it seems like he's going to go down the way he wants to here.
I think there's a fundamental conversation about Dubas and, you know, when they let him take over and, you know, the Lou thing. We don't need to get into that. But there's a big element of him sort of learning the NHL job on the fly in the biggest window in Leafs history. That's pretty scary for the Leafs when you look back on this.
But I don't need to go back to that.
To me, the question is, at this point. Like, looking back,
kind of.
They've had the best roster, the roster that everyone looked on. Like, if you look back over this year and said they wouldn't have won one round, everyone would have been just devastated. Like,
no, but that's,
this is,
so that's
this
why
has
we're
not
here.
Gone well.
That's why we're it hasn't gone well. And this is, again, this is the point I was making earlier, is that I think that he has done a pretty bad job as the general manager of the Leafs, and I'm not really sure how you could say he's done a good one, all things considered. Like, again, they haven't won a playoff round. You can say, oh, well, some of that has been luck and, you know, the way they changed the format and however you want to spin it, that it hasn't been done. And there have been years where it was, like, very lackluster, like the Montreal exit and the Columbus exits, like, most specifically. He's overpaid his biggest free agents. He has not won in the trade market basically ever. Like, again, best moves, trade downs at the draft, acquiring more depth and then hitting on a couple of those, like, long shots, those picks. I think that you could give him some credit for moves like the value that he got back for Kapanen at the time, I think, was more than people thought. And that's just, again, that's bad luck with Amarov getting sick. That's, like, awful and unfortunate. He's definitely had some free agency signings that have been good, but he's had some of the worst trades out of any general manager. And now his team appears to be, like, on the back end of a window with some of, like, the biggest stars in the NHL filling around the edges with, like, Adam Godets of the world taking lottery shots on goaltenders that didn't have a lot of value around the league and still, like, not having space for the few guys that he seems to have kind of hit on in Sandin and Liljegren in terms of, like, their ability for, like, upward mobility. It's not good. Like, it's just, it's, I don't think that you could look at this and say, good, this has been a great job. I lost my train of thought here. I was trying to just kind of re-go back on not having it be about then, but more about now. Is I would just say that I don't trust where the Leafs are at today, and I don't trust their ability to kind of be able to yeah, be closer to a Stanley Cup than they were at the end of last season. I just don't.
Yeah, no, and it is tough to see what the plan is here and how the vision gets executed. I think, you know, Dubas probably sitting there is going, you know, we finished fourth in the NHL last regular season. Like, they were a good hockey team. What, you know, are we significantly different than that team last year? I think you can argue that as of today, they're a little bit worse, you know, which still leaves you as a pretty good hockey team in the league. And then can you do something from there to get better, to fill in as the season goes on, to make changes as need be? That remains to be seen. But, boy, does he need Matt Murray to be good. Oh, boy, staking it all on Matt Murray.
Yeah, and by the way, I remember where I was going, and we'll let you go on this, is like you asked if you wanted to have a general manager with conviction, and I would say yes, you absolutely do. But I think what separates people in sports, and this is a tease in terms of the interview that's going to come up about Matt Murray, is that the great players, the great coaches, the great general managers, the great front offices, they are about making adjustments to the vision. And Kyle Dubas has always preached that he is a guy that is always open to the best idea and to being flexible and not seeing things one way. And I'll read my philosophy books and be a different guy. And I'm an Epstein guy. And I'm a big student of all the different sports and all the different games. So then why is it that it's a stubborn vision? Then why is it that the vision only includes kind of, you know, one path forward and has things like slogans like we can and we will? Like, that doesn't seem to be something that happens with other great front offices, other great general managers. And so I think if he wants to be one, then he should have been able to kind of check a little bit of that hubris that you kind of outlined there. Anyway, I know you got to run. So thank you, Justin Bourne. Thank you for your time. And again, I will look forward to listening to you and Sam when my show is over today.
All right, guys.
See you, buddy. Justin Bourne.
So quick, we have time for something quick there, though.
Yeah, quickly.
I do think that he does deserve credit for, you change in the vision. He has completely revamped the bottom six three or four times in three different styles or whatever. Like, he's gone from the young fast to the old slow sort of, you know, plodding, grittier bottom six. Like, that part of his philosophy has changed a little bit, but the core philosophy of the big four has never changed. He has changed some things. Like, we can't be completely unfair. The bottom six has been moved around a lot. He's tried different ways in the bottom six, and that is a change. But like you said, the fundamental sort of vision of this team with the four big guys making most of the money has never changed. So you can get him on that, but I just wanted to be fair with the bottom six stuff.
So I'm going to kind of push back on that. His bottom six, it was forced because the Marlies were so deep. He had to, like, Kapanen was always coming up, right? Like, if you look at when you're going, well, they went with the young fast. Yeah, because that's exactly what everybody in the league should covet, which is your own internal players who are going to come out. Like, think about where the Leafs were at from a timeline standpoint. Like, they already had Nazem Kadri here, and they signed John Tavares. So when we're talking about, like, different bottom sixes they had, they used to have Nazem Kadri here. He, again, inherited guys like Connor Brown. Like, again, this team didn't just inherit the four guys, right? Like, you inherited Nazem Kadri. You inherited Connor Brown. Like, there's a lot that was here when he came in. You inherited James Van Riemsdyk, who got a huge contract after he left. You inherited Morgan Rielly. A lot of different players and infrastructure was here. So coming in, I don't think, like, you're looking at, like, revamping the bottom sixes, because a lot of it was already set up before you. And he deserves credit for the AHL guys, I think, is, like, the fair part of this. Is, like, he had a big hand to play with what happened at the AHL, how they developed these guys, some of the teams that they built around them, going out and actually winning the Calder Trophy. But if you're telling me, like, revamp bottom six, I don't think it was that drastic. I think what ended up happening is, when we're saying they really tried to do a different complexion, that they just signed the veteran free agents that were available at lower money. Like, Spezza came in at basically a free salary, and they said, yeah, we'll do that. You're Jason Spezza. Wayne Simmonds came back and said, yeah, I'm willing to play here for less than market value. And they went, we have to do that. I just don't think that the whole bottom six storyline that's happened before of, like, he's willing to change his philosophy because he was willing to go get Kyle Clifford, again, a guy that he was familiar with and a guy that came in on the cheap, is really all that big of an acknowledgement that they were willing to do that. To me, it would have been a bigger sign if they had gone out and said, we're spending big money on someone that is a bottom six superstar, which they've never done. That would be a big philosophical change. But realistically, it's like, The complexion in terms of what you're saying
is that it's just they've just signed different cheap guys, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. It's like whoever's been available at the cheap, who's ever been able to kind of
fit there is more
the way they go with it. Like if that's a guy that's better at the AHL level, they've promoted them. If it's a guy who's a better free agent, they'll go with it. But it's never like they've never had a fourth line of guys where it was like, oh, this is a scary line. They wanted a checking line last year. Guess what? Everybody wants a checking line. That's not like a philosophical departure. They wanted that with Kapanen too. Like they've had that from the very beginning, wanting a checking line. And that's what. Remember when they did that with Kadri the year one, where it was, hey, Kadri goes and he shuts people down. He's the McDavid stopper. Should he get Selke nominations? Like they've always had
a checking line. So, that was that regular season game where he shut down McDavid. Anyways,
it was. I'm just saying I don't really buy the like big tweaks and philosophy changes. I think it's just like the overarching theme is that it's these four guys and that those contracts weren't bad and that they'll work around it at whatever cost, whether it's own rentals or draft picks or whatever it takes. Anyway, let's take a break. The goaltenders have been kind of the celebrated part of this offseason and the most polarizing part of this offseason with Matt Murray. I talked to Kevin Woodley yesterday, a guy who knows both these guys very intimately and who I think is like the most knowledgeable media member right now on breaking down the goalie position through analytics and through tape and through actually being involved with a lot of, you know, looking at these teams. So Kevin Woodley on why Matt Murray became how Matt Murray went from being the Stanley Cup winner, potentially future Team Canada guy, to what we saw in Ottawa beyond the injuries, how he can change in Toronto, and what do the Leafs actually have in Ilya Samsonov? That's next on the Fan Morning Show with JD Bunkus and Sam McKee, Sports.5.9 of the Fan.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The Leafs have two new goalies, and so you got to talk to the guy that knows the position best in media right now. It's the man from In Goal Magazine, covering the NHL or covering the Canucks with NHL.com. It's Kevin Woodley. Kevin is In Goal on Twitter. What's up, buddy?
Not much. The game of musical chairs was a different one this year, eh? We always used to see them flying around in free agency. A little more trades thrown in the mix this year. But nonetheless, a fascinating day when it comes to goaltender movement. I mean, movement in every regard, but for me, obviously, it's the musical chairs and the crease that count the most.
Yeah, and that was the thing with Toronto this year, right? Like, there was a ton of focus on what they were going to do in net. And it got weird, I would say, about 2 weeks before free agency when we found out that Campbell and the Leafs weren't even talking. And you know, sometimes, you know, you're around media long enough, you go, this is just games, this is whatever. And then there would be people starting to pop up going, nah, it's kind of more than this. And Toronto's not really looking there. Then it became, as I was talking to a few people, apparently, like, the Leafs really loved Ville Husso and that they loved him. And that then there was Marc-Andre Fleury buzz about him fitting the timeline and him being an accomplished guy. And it feels a little bit like they hit the secondary market here. I guess let's just start with this. If you had had your pick of the litter out of all of these guys and the contracts that you've seen so far and the deals you've seen so far, who would have been your guy for this Leafs team?
Ooh, that's a tough one. This is why they make a lot more money to make these decisions than I do to analyze them. You know, like for example, I like Darcy Kuemper. He had a not very good playoffs, and in some ways, Colorado showed that you could win a cup, I don't want to say despite goaltending, but without needing goaltending to be a primary factor for you, by doing so with Darcy not at his best, clearly, and I think some of that, maybe a lot of it, was related to the eye injury sustained in the first round. And Pavel Francouz, you know, with, you know, some decent outings, but overall, like, neither one of those guys were net positive relative to expected save percentage by ClearSight Analytics, and they won a cup. So, despite that, I like Darcy's game over the last couple of years. I think there are some elements in his game that would be easily fixed, the tendency to sort of never set and drift a lot. So I see upside there, and even with some of the elements I would prefer to see changed, he still produced, you know, that's a really goalie environment in Colorado. But he finished, you know, second half of the season was really good, plus 1.2 on the save percentage by ClearSight, you know, and into the top 10. And if he had another full season like his second half of the season, I think he had a chance to be in the Vezina conversation. And yet saying all that and maybe liking that fit a little more than the way they went, you know, at the risk of my goalie union card being plucked out of my wallet at any moment, there's one thing I'd avoid when it comes to the them, and I could control all the elements. It would be Darcy's 32, and so I have questions there, and there's injury history there as well. So there are positives and negatives in every decision. I know there's been a lot of blowback on Matt Murray as the option they chose. I happen to see a lot of upside in Matt's game still. I'm familiar with a lot of the changes that Matt has already initiated. And I see in both results and in his game when I watch him in Ottawa, some of those changes have had a positive impact. And I see that as a progression that can continue, along with maybe there are some other areas I also see the need for change in his game. You know, I think his post play when he arrived in Ottawa was frankly bordered on antiquated. It wasn't modernized. It was something they went to work on a little bit, but I don't know that it changed enough. I am not putting Curtis Sanford in the Benoit Lair, Francois Lair, Mitch Korn, Ian Clark, should be in the Hall of Fame one day conversation yet. But I really like Curtis as a coach. And so when we talk about things like post play with Matt, I see that as something that Curtis is equipped to fix really quickly. Matt Murray and the way he won a cup, the way he played when he won the two cups in Pittsburgh, no longer works in the National Hockey League. This isn't Matt Murray forgetting how to play goal. This is Matt Murray having success with a setup and a stance and a style that just no longer works anymore. And I don't think that's really necessarily his fault. I think you could blame some of the people around him in Pittsburgh for not starting to change those things earlier in his game, but he was too low, too wide, too soon, locked in. The game has become very east-west. He was insulated from it in Pittsburgh, in part by the personnel when they won the Cups, but in part by the fact that they recognized that first. You saw him slide a lot on lateral plays, on cross-ice passes, rather than beat them on his feet. And so the process of narrowing up your stance, and for Curtis Sanford, he will have learned it here under Ian Clark. They use a three-stance system. I'll be curious to see if he implements that with Matt. But the process of narrowing up his stance to facilitate better east-west movement without having to get locked in and having to default to sliding on your knees, beating plays on your skates, keeping your feet under you. I think what you like if you're the Leafs is the fact that Matt initiated those changes on his own before the trade to Ottawa. He sought out a trainer in Adam Francilia who works out of Kelowna, and some people may recognize the name. He worked with James Reimer for years. He worked with Connor Hellebuck, started the year before Connor had his breakout season. Worked with Mike Smith the last 2 years, was a big part of the changes in Mike Smith's game that allowed him, for all the faults that are still there, to have a lot of statistical success his last two seasons compared to the five before that. During the break after the pandemic pause in 2020, he went to work on sort of rebuilding how he trained off the ice so he could better hold a good posture, including that narrowed stance, better hold a stance and a posture that would allow him to make these changes more easily. And he initiated that. And so that's a positive because he sees the need for change and he's embraced it. I just think it went off the rails in Ottawa for a lot of different reasons. They fired the goalie coach three quarters of the way through the season who understood where that process was going and how long it would take. And there was very clearly a disconnect between the rest of the coaching staff and Matt throughout his 2 years there, you know, right down to the way injuries were handled and, you know, some of the back channels that were used to sort of, you know, speak about the way Matt was handling injuries when, in fact, some of the injuries were actually created by the way they were handled by the staff there. So I think it just was never going to be – it could have been a fit there early, but for all the talk about embracing a long process to help Matt transition his game, it never really – that patience was never really shown on the ice in that first year, and I think everything crumbled from there. So there are changes that still need to be made, but there are a lot of positives, I think, in the fact that Matt initiated them on his own. You get a motivated guy. You know, and a good goalie coach in Curtis Sanford. Obviously, John Elkin, a lot's been made about the ties there. There's just a familiarity there. And if he can stay healthy, and that's a big question mark when it comes to Matt Murray over the past two seasons, but if he can, I actually don't worry that much about his game. I see enough transition having already started with Matt. He's not like he forgot how to play goal. It's just the way he played it no longer works in the NHL, but he's already started to make those changes.
So there was a lot of like really interesting stuff that you said there. And so I'm going to try to go
through. I just talk a lot, so there was a lot there.
Yeah. Listen, that was a long answer, but there was an insightful answer, and like, yeah, I'm going to be basically like Michael Scott here. You know, explain it to me like I'm five with some of the things, because one thing you said, I think that really stuck out is about the injuries, right? Because I think that for a lot of people, they're not going to, and this is myself included, they're not looking at Matt Murray's style from Pittsburgh to Ottawa and seeing that as the difference. The vast majority of people are going to say, oh, okay, this guy's playing behind a much worse defensive team than he was, or a much worse team just in general in Ottawa. And when things started to spiral, like, the guy started to lose a little bit. And you think of that position as such a one with confidence, and then you compile injuries with that, and now he's kind of got that tag as an injury-prone player. And that was even something that was, like, early on in his career. So just, like, the first thing I'm going to kind of focus in on there is that, you know, you mentioned, I don't want to put words in your mouth directly, but something along the lines of, like, the injuries could have been maybe mitigated a little bit better, or that they could have been handled a little bit better. That is there a part of you that believes that maybe Matt Murray's reputation as an injury-prone guy is not going to be the same if he is handled differently?
I think that's possible, and I don't want to overstate it because it sounds like I'm throwing a lot of barbs. And there was only one injury in particular that cost him a month in that first season there. That I really think, you know, it was sort of throwing on him. But the truth is, it really wasn't on him, frankly. It was the one where he pulled himself from the start. And I think there was a lot of eyebrows raised and frankly, shade thrown, including from people within the organization to members of the media, about that decision, about Matt pulling the chute that way. But, you know, the reality is, when you understand the background of the situation, shouldn't have been playing that night. And the damage that was done was sort of inflicted through treatment. Like, a nerve was pinched, couldn't close the glove, couldn't move the glove hand. Obviously couldn't play, didn't play for a long time after that. But rather than that being, you know, I heard some of the whispers and have an idea where they came from, but, you know, Matt Murray pulling the chute, I didn't see it that way. And I don't think that was accurate, and I don't think that was fair. Now, that's not to say that some of the other injuries, like, you know, that's just one. It happened to be the biggest one. It cost him the most time. The head injuries are probably a concern, but I've seen goalies go to organizations where, you know, whether it's treatment or a diagnosis that, you know, they were told they were okay, they played through it, it got worse. Like, that trust can get broken pretty quick. And I don't want to, you know, I haven't talked to him about this specifically, so I'm not putting words in his, I'm not saying this comes from him, but I can't help but wonder from the outside, knowing the background on at least one of those instances, how quickly that derails your confidence in your ability to trust treatment and your body, and trust when other people are telling you it's okay, don't worry about what you're feeling. And frankly, the way things went, the way they dumped him to the minors early on, like, you playing through much at that point? Like, are you know what I mean? Like, are you battling through something if you have questions about maybe not feeling at 100% when you're in a situation where they've basically throwing you under the bus on a regular basis.
I think this is what Freddie Anderson went through his final year in Toronto, where he felt like he was playing through an injury, and his reward was to be kind of cast aside by the organization, and you saw like his urgency level when it came to returning. So I think that happens with the position. I think that happens in pro sports in general with all positions. And so, yeah, you can empathize with him to a certain degree with that. So we went over some of the things, and this is going to be, again, the Michael Scott explained it to me like I'm five, kind of two-part question here. But one is, okay, so you talked about stylistic changes and the game changing and Matt Murray needing to make adjustments, and then specifically with right now his post-play not being up to snuff. I think that the natural follow-off of this is a two-parter. One is that, is he a talented enough guy where he deserves that kind of, don't worry, this guy can make those adjustments? Like, don't worry, this guy will be able to modernize his game? Or was this like a very situationally dependent thing that you saw in Pittsburgh? And two is kind of, Well, how much of that stylistic change did lead into the 18 games that everyone loves to cherry pick from that were incredible last year before the, you know, before the end of the season? He had two horrific games to close it that really blew up the save percentage, but I think he was .941 save behind a pretty terrible Ottawa Senators team for an 18 game stretch at the end of the year. Did you start to see those things translate there? Or do you view that kind of a period as, well, that's just, you know, variance over, you know, a 3-year season and we're picking out a very, very select sample?
Well, I looked at the numbers. I think his adjusted save percentage for the season last year on ClearSight Analytics was plus 0.7%. You know, like similar to Eric Comrie, who had a raw .920, right? Like he was taught, it was right around 15th in the NHL. For the record, Jack Campbell finished 30th. Just barely above expected. Like, so it's not just the 18 games. The season of, as a whole, including the blow-ups, had a lot of positives. And I'll actually go back to the year before. I saw positives in those changes taking hold 2 years ago at that three-quarter point. And it was after he missed a month. Now, he was out for a month. What a lot of people don't realize is he skated every day in that month because it was an upper body injury, so he could still skate. The first 3 weeks of that month, he skated every day with the goalie coach they fired 3 weeks into the month off. And then the last week, the new guy came in. I'm not sure how much they skated, but they skated every day. And so that was – sometimes you need to – when you're making changes like that, it's hard to do it in season. You need to pull back and get back to work on the foundational stuff because it's hard to sort of trust it in games. And you can – like a golfer who's making a swing change gets into the back nine under pressure on a Sunday and double-crosses himself because the old swing came back under pressure. It's hard to sort of make these changes innate under the pressure of a season when you're playing a lot. And so I wasn't surprised after that injury, knowing that he'd skated every day for 3 weeks, the setup, the stance, the movement that it should facilitate in terms of having his feet closer together and underneath him narrower than he used to be in Pittsburgh, which makes, of course, you think about it. Like, if your legs are way out, like a big, wide sort of butterfly setup stance, you can't move out of that. You're locked in. You're low. You're wide. When you make a T-push, whether you're a skater or a goalie, the power comes from being able to extend and push that push leg. Well, if your legs are already way out to the sides, you've got no extension left. You've got no power. You've got no push. You have to pull that lead leg in and gather your feet before you go. Narrowing the stance and changing his posture got rid of a lot of that. But it's, again, not an easy change to make. Not a coincidence in my mind that it was after the month off with injury and all the skating work they did. And by the way, they also changed his equipment during that time. New pads, new gloves, in particular softer pads with more flex that wouldn't sort of limit or push against that type of movement pattern. I think that actually made a big difference and was a change sort of led by the former goalie coach there. I saw signs when he came out of that injury, including he came here through Vancouver, and it was also a short stretch. But if you look, and it ended again, and this is where the risk is, it ended with, I believe, a knee injury, and that was it for the season. But if you go back and pull that sample, and I got to be honest, it may be as short as 5 or 6 games, but I'm willing to bet the numbers, both raw and adjusted, coming off that one-month injury to whenever the next injury was, jump out off the page as much as that 18-game sample of last season. And more to the point, if you look at the video, the changes are obvious. So I think they have started to take hold. I think the fact he enters the situation where they'll be properly reinforced with the consistency from top to bottom, with an understanding, I would hope, from top to bottom that these changes are necessary and that there might be some hiccups as they become innate and instinctual and comfortable for him still, even 2 years in, I think will allow him to get there sooner. You know, because Ottawa, he finished the season great 2 years ago. What did Ottawa do at the beginning of the season? Dumped him to the American Hockey League promptly, right? So, you know, I think there's a goalie there. There is risk. There is risk with injuries. But I think the risk when it comes to his game is a lot less than most people would tell you right now.
Okay, is there a goalie in the other guy that the Leafs signed? Because, again, you have far more numbers and insight into this player, but they signed Ilya Samsonov, and it looks like a smart move from Washington's standpoint, letting him go, just because it looked like he was going to command $3 million. He only gets the 1 year at 1.8 with Toronto. His goals saved above average last year, minus 12.5. Basically beyond his, you know, rookie season when he was a 22-year-old, yeah, the numbers across the board are not overly strong with this guy. What are your feelings about Samsonov? Because a lot of people here seem to be very, very excited about getting him, but I feel like that, you know, I don't really know how to actually feel about this.
Yeah, no, like the numbers I have aren't any more impressive. Like that was a pretty goalie-friendly environment in Washington last year, and he didn't excel in it. So the thing I would equate it to, possibly, is Jacob Markstrom leaving Florida. And the reason I say that is because, much like Jacob when he left Florida, or when he was in Florida, he was a very highly touted goalie of the future type. You know, for the longest time, Jacob had that label as the best goalie not in the National Hockey League. The problem was, again, we talk about style. Jacob in Florida was, he's 6'5" or 6'6" and just like so needlessly aggressive. And for a big goalie, just needlessly opened up holes with all the extra movement, playing well outside his crease, like trying to be athletic, and frankly failing at it. And watching from the outside, I remember because we had the Calgary Flames farm team was in Abbotsford in the AHL at the time. I remember watching him come through and just being like, why? Like, my God, he's a behemoth. Why is he out there? Why is he moving this much? And people much smarter than I in that organization must have been able to see the same thing. But sometimes when you're that highly touted, sometimes when you've had that much success at the lower levels and coming up, it's really hard to convince a guy to change because it's always worked for him. And I do know that early in Ilya Samsonov's tenure with Washington, you know, dating back to the days when Mitch Korn was still there, when he first arrived, you know, talking to some people in Russia, like he would be sent home with like, hey, we need to work on this. You know, and the goalie coaches there would be like, he'd get home and be like, well, I'm not changing this, right? Like, because it worked for him. And so I do think there is an element of that. And sometimes it takes rock bottom. Sometimes it takes changing a team. I'll never forget when Markstrom arrived here and the first change they tried to make under Rolly Melanson at the time was sort of reining in those positional habits I just talked about. And that was the first of many changes. There was a big evolution for him here through multiple goalie coaches. But that was a pretty simple one, the first one. And I remember him confiding in me after the season that he initially sort of bristled at it and pushed back because the mindset for him was, hey, you just acquired me. You like me. Why are you trying to change me? So despite not succeeding and not rising as fast as most had predicted in Florida, there was still a resistance to change. And so I think there has been through his time in Washington a bit of that for Ilya. I think that 3/4 of the way through this season, they attacked some of the things that I just talked about with Matt. When he would, in terms of setup and stance, which it's a massive foundation for a goalie's game. Ilya had a tendency to sort of bend over at the waist and sort of lower his chest to the ice from the hips to the point where the logo would disappear. You know, you talk to me like I'm 5. Go watch his tape. When his logo disappears in the top of his pads, he has to open up to get to the ice on a save execution. He has to open up to move east-west. He has trouble keeping his legs and his skates underneath him. He gets pretty wild back and forth, a lot of excess movement going east-west. And when he manages to sort of lower into a save stance with his legs and not through his chest, everything is better. It's like an on-off switch for him. And he didn't really buy into that until about the 3/4 mark of the season. And that's pretty late in the game to be trying to make changes. But it shows to me a receptiveness to those changes, finally, belatedly, and that's a positive. You're not going to have to fight uphill to make him understand that the way things were going and the way he was playing needs to change. And I thought I actually saw a lot of more positives down the stretch for him last year and even into the playoffs. But again, much like Matt, you try and make those changes in a season, like they're going to come and go. And like I said, like stance and setup-wise, it was almost like an on-off switch for him. When you look through the video, when he was good and when he was bad. But again, if you can get him to buy into that in the off season, to buy into that with the coaching staff, there's still a goalie there. I do think there may be four more physical limitations in Ilya's game than there was in Markstrom's. He does not have a wide butterfly. It's pretty narrow. You'll see a lot of times when he's down on his knees in the crease and there's pucks sort of, you know, in tight plays, the legs become, like, for lack of a better term, pinball flippers. They're kicking out left, right, and center all over the place. You know, if he had a wider butterfly base, you know, he'd be able to make those saves without having to extend. He'd be able to push through his hips rather than having to kick his legs out. When you have to extend with your feet rather than pushing through the hips, your knee tends to come off the ice when you extend, which, you know, breaks the seal and causes leaky goals. Now, what I can't answer is that deficiency physical and this is just what the limitations of his body are? Or, again, when we talk about changes, has he not done the work? Did he not get pushed into an FRC-type training, isometrical holds that will allow him to develop more mobility through the hips? I think, you know, again, not knowing the answers, but those are questions I'd be asking in Toronto and things I'd be pushing on him. Because if you could get a little more width, a little more length in his game in terms of he's got the right stature, he just doesn't sort of isn't able to use it in its most effective manner. Then not only is there a goalie there, but there's the capability of a really, really good, like the upside just gets that much higher if, you know, you can fix some of the physical limitations along with making some of the technical and tactical adjustments that just never seemed to take hold or never got started early enough when he was with Washington. And again, I'm not blaming the staffs there. To me, that's more about a guy with a lot of talent that maybe wasn't willing to go all in and do the work required to commit to those changes early enough in his career.
I got to tell you, there's a lot to take from this interview, and I do appreciate the time, but holy, it sure sounds like John Elkin and Curtis Sanford aren't going to be, you know, having the most relaxing of summers. That you're going to know those two guys' names probably one way or the other after this Leafs summer, after these signings. It seems like those guys have some work cut out, and I do like knowing that at least there could be a goalie there. I think that's really exciting for a lot of Leafs fans, for those people. Kevin Woodley, again, at Kevin is in goal. The best, in my opinion, goalie follow that there is in the NHL media right now. In Goal Magazine, make sure that you subscribe, do all those things. Thanks so much for making time today, man. We always appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. And let me tell you, if you want an example of what Curtis Sanford can do, look no further than Spencer Martin. Arrived fifth on the depth chart with the Vancouver Canucks last year. Made a lot of the changes I'm talking about. Three-stance system, the way he moved, the way he holds his body, the way his setup and stance are executed. Had a 950-plus with the Canucks down the stretch. Will be their backup next year. And that was within the span of one season for a guy that did not have any of the sort of highly regarded background that Ilya Samsonov or Matt Murray even come from. So I'm not promising miracles, but Curtis is a hell of a goalie coach. They got a good one in Toronto.
That was Kevin Woodley of In Goal Magazine. This is the Fan Morning Show. I'm JD Bunkus. Sam McKee joining me. Charlie's gone. What now? What next? How are we feeling? It's the Fan Morning Show. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.